This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Last programme on the Antiques Radio Show, we had an alliteration of interesting items sold, all starting with the letter B. This time, it's sibilant sales. Something in a series, something saucy, and something ursine. We go on to see what's cooking with provenance, that's the history of an item, who owned it, etc. Our problem page includes a very expensive item under the hammer, but just how much was it? And there's a problem of identity. What actually is a museum? Do you know? Do the museums know? Stay tuned for some interesting insights. And we'll start with our sibilant sales. Do you remember dinky cars? Those little cars that one used to play with such great joy? Well, the Antique Trade Gazette of the 24th of August has this to tell us about them. Dinky delivers in sale. Two rare pre-war dinky trade boxes, which had been in loft storage for two generations, appeared for sale in Lincolnshire. Toy specialist M&M Auctions, which has a 21.6% buyer's premium including VAT, in Spalding offered them on behalf of a family who had owned the toys since new in the mid-1930s. Prices have undoubtedly softened for some of the earlier dinky toys that no longer connect so directly with the collecting audience. Nevertheless, the holy grail of dinky collecting remains these 1930s No. 28 delivery vans, advertising commercial brand names. Surviving first-type vehicles are rare in any state, but condition, as always, is key. The highest price in the August the 8th to the 9th went to a box of six dinky 28 series circa 1935 bearing nationally recognised trade names Oxo Beef, Kodak Film, Dunlop Tyres, Marsh's Sausages, Wakefield Castrol and Crawford's. Each was considered an exceptional example with very minor fatigue crazing and minimal paint loss, and they came in the printed yellow card trade box with dividers that had held them for many years. Estimated at £4,000 to £7,000, they sold for £10,200 to a UK buyer via the saleroom.com. That's approximately $20,000 all up. The same digital paddle secured a slightly later box of six delivery vans circa 1938, with decals for Golden Shred Marmalade, Secateen Sticks Everything, Manchester Guardian, Firestone Tyres, Atco Motor Mowers and Virol. These sold for £9,500. Historically, these are not huge prices. Back in 2014, Special Auction Services in Newbury offered two first-issue 1934 sets of six dinky vans and sold them for £20,000 and £19,000. Another first-issue box took £30,000 at Vectis of Stockton-on-Tees in March 2008 at a sale where one-of-a-kind van bearing the name W.E. Boyce, a cycle shop on the Archway Road in Highgate, London, in the 1930s, sold for a record £17,000. That's well over $30,000 all up. Thank you, Roland Arkell of the Antique Trade Gazette. And now, diverting from dinkies to another fancied following, in the days before computer dating, cyber services of a personal nature, and internet escorts, how and where could you achieve a dalliance? Well, the Antique Trade Gazette of the 20th of July tells us. It reads, "Fancied fillies and fancy embroidery. An 1841 guide to London's ladies of the night, sold by Hanson's for £3,300, featured recently in Antique Trade Gazette number 2390, and one of many rarities that emerged from the recent Gloucestershire sale of the late Martin Orski's library, was a group of four 18th century broadsides advertising prostitutes. In the Dominic Winter sale, with a 20% buyer's premium, of 26th of June, bidding reached £14,000 for these broadsides. They bear such titles as The Only True List of Those Celebrating Sporting Ladies or Petticoat Amblers Who Afford the Bucks and Bloods an Amorous Felicity Every Evening During the Races. A few other such broadsides are recorded, but this group is not among them. All but one incorporates a woodcut illustration at the head of the satirical text that describes the attributes of the ladies, and two actually cite rates or prices. For a flying stroke, sixpence. All night, 2 shillings. Advertisements for prostitutes attending unspecified race meetings, they were extracted by Orski from a volume of chap books published in Lichfield in the 1770s, and describe in ribald prose the various attributes and skills of ladies whose working names included Jenny Fouryard, Cleopatra Tickleback, Polly Trim, Jenny Spruce, and Lucy Pleasant. These sporting ladies trying their fortunes in the jockeying trade, we are told, come from diverse places in England and Scotland, those formerly preparing fruit to make wooden drink in Ciderland. Another, from the other side of the Tweed, are likewise come a numerous string of brimstones who may be heard of the oatmeal grinders in Watergruel Square. They are now warranted clear of the scrub, having been well fumigated since their arrival in England. And now for something a little more sibilantly salubrious and circumspect, ceramics. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 17th of August. Sale supplies simple bare accessories of life. When auctioneer Tony Pratt spotted a mysterious shape in the undergrowth of a back garden in Hythe, he wasn't expecting to uncover a very large pottery bear. The contents of this particular Kentish residence was a veritable treasure trove and provided the Canterbury Auction Galleries with more than 100 lots for its August 3-day sale. But the pottery bear proved to be one of the most memorable finds from Pratt's visit. I was about to leave when it occurred to me that it might be worth checking the garden to see if anything there might be suitable for sale, he said. The grass hadn't been cut for years, and some of the weeds were up to my shoulders, but I spotted a shape in the undergrowth and thought it was worth trying to get closer. I was amazed when it turned out to be a pottery statue of a brown bear, almost 3 feet tall. It was an unexpected but highly amusing discovery. This discovery was welcomed by Dalton Lambeth collectors. Against an estimate of £2,000 to £3,000 in the August the 7th sale, the 2-foot-5-inch, that's 75 centimetre, high salt-glazed stoneware brown bear took £8,000, plus 20% buyer's premium. The winning buyer, a private collector living in South Yorkshire, told Pratt he'd seen it advertised in the Antique Trade Gazette and bought it, just because I liked it. The bear is likely to be the work of Royal Dalton artist Mark V. Marshall, who worked at the firm from circa 1878 to 1912. Marshall, like fellow Dalton artist George Tinworth, trained at the Lambeth School of Art and previously worked at the Martin Brothers Pottery. A similar but very much smaller, at 3¼ inches, that's 9.5 centimetres high, circa 1900 stoneware bear with honey pot, sold at Bonhams in March 2009 for a premium inclusive £540. Pratt said, "We were aware of the possibility that it was by Marshall, and there were discussions with several potential buyers during the 3 days of viewing. However, the only mark on the piece was the usual Dalton Lambeth impress trademark, and as a result we would not have been comfortable in attributing the piece to him in the cataloguing." Prices for Dalton Lambeth have weakened over the past decade or so, but for unusual items such as this sizeable bear, collectors are willing to compete, despite a chip to its ear. And that was written by Laura Chesters in the Antique Trade Gazette. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. Let's turn now to provenance. That's the previous history and ownership of an item. So important if you're paying a premium for something because it belonged to someone famous. Also in cases of restitution to a rightful owner of something stolen or illegally traded. But first, the dramatis personae. The poet Horace. His full name was Quintus Horatius Flaccus, and he lived in Rome from 65 BC to 8 BC. And our second person, well, you know who Captain Cook is, don't you? And from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 24th of August, we read, Horace taken to new heights by Captain Cook notes. The reason that an otherwise unexceptional 1737 English language edition of Horace's Odes, Satires and Epistles, lacking a portrait and three text pages, sold for the substantial sum of £50,000 in Bonhams, where there is a variable buyer's premium, on the 26th of June. It's found on the front end paper notes illustrated right. This was one of the books that William Perry's surgeon mate, and later surgeon, on the Endeavour, took with him on Captain Cook's first circumnavigation of the globe in 1768-71. On one page, Perry notes details of the ship's officers, crew and passengers, servants, etc. The name of Cook and the naturalist Joseph Banks are prominently displayed, but also on the list is the American-born seaman of Corsican ancestry, James Magra, who, on their return to England and to the great annoyance of the authorities, published the unauthorised first account of that historic voyage. On the opposing page, boldly titled Tales of Horace, Endeavour, 6th Septem of Cape Finisterre, 1768, Perry has added his own name above dated notes of their departure and return to England. Most books taken on the voyage would have related to navigation, other voyages, science and natural history, and both Banks and the expedition artists, Sidney Parkinson, had private libraries at their disposal. The former's books are now housed in the British Library. Other officers may well have brought along recreational reading matter, but Bonhams could trace only one other book taken aboard the Endeavour, and that too was part of Perry's personal library. This was a copy of Malcolm Fleming's Introduction to Physiology, 1759, offered by Australian dealer Horden House in 2005 as part of the Parsons Collection Rare Pacific Voyage Books, and is now in the Granger Museum and Collections at Melbourne University. Now let's stay anchored in the Antipodes for a fascinating auction held by Shapiro Auctioneers of Woollahra, Sydney. The Sydney Morning Herald of the 28th of August tells it all. Nick O'Malley writes as follows. Part garage sale, part relic hunt, hammer falls on hawks, keepsakes. There was an odd mood at the Paddington Town Hall when people gathered for their chance to buy a trinket from a collection of more than 200 possessions of the former Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, at dusk. Before bidding began, the tone was hushed, as though this was another requiem for the beloved former Labour leader. Sam Crosby, the Labour candidate for Reid at the past election, one of the few to win a swing his way, bought a beer and confessed that he was a Hawke fanboy. He had an eye for the remnants of Hawke's library, a collection that looked as though it had been thoroughly picked over before being consigned to the auctioneers. Anulok Chandviong, the state Labour MP for Macquarie Fields, stood at the back. Like others, he was not after anything in particular, just something that speaks of Bob, maybe the cigar stuff, he said, referring to a collection of humidors, cigar boxes and accoutrements for sale. Another man who lives around the corner from the RSL and did not want to be named said he was there out of interest in both cigars and Hawke. He has never voted Labour, he says, but he remembers how Hawke's income support for families changed his parents' life. In truth, there was little of any significant intrinsic value in the catalogue, not when you consider what a wealthy man Hawke had become after he left office. There were couches, lots of couches, enough modernist Italian couches to furnish Bob and Blanche's famed four-story Northbridge mansion, an artwork that was once described in the Good Weekend as unchallengingly pleasant. In that piece, Ms. Dalpuget confessed to writer Janet Hawley that she had made early mistakes in decorating and had to dispatch the bad paintings to Hawke's office on William Street. A painting from the office, Hugh Sorey's The Drover's Wife, sold for $23,000, $11,000 over the estimate. It's not clear if it was one of the bad ones. A miniature Chinese open bookcase, given to Hawke as a diplomatic gift by Zhao Xiang, China's premier between 1980 and 1987, was valued bafflingly at being worth between $300 and $500. Bidding opened at $13,000, and the bookcase, along with assorted Yangjian teapots, eventually sold for $20,000 to James Xi, who said he'd admired Hawke since arriving in the country 30 years ago. At some point, it became clear that there were really two auctions going on. Some lots were being snapped up by the sort of buyers who are always out for a deal when a family has to tidy up the odds and ends of a beloved parent's life. The impersonal items, the couches and the coffee tables were cleaned up this way. But by the time of his death, Hawke was something like an Australian secular saint, so the objects that he handled, the things that he cared about, that signalled his status, the things that he ate with and drank with, the things that he smoked with, have taken on significance of relics. A silver-footed bowl presented to Hawke by the then US Secretary of State Dick Cheney, when he was the United States Secretary of Defense, went for $7,500 after being listed for $700. A bowl given to Hawke when he opened a runway in Iceland also dropped for $7,500. Then a couple of silver bowls with frogs on them went for $22,000. A Versace ashtray, with an estimated value of $200, went for $1,400. A Cambodian cigar box for $2,600, and a Persian cigarette case for $1,400. "He was the greatest Prime Minister I'll ever see in my lifetime," said 36-year-old Joel Bryden, as he waited for Lot 172, a chrome and linen floor lamp, to come up. He liked to think of himself reading a copy of Hawke's memoirs under it one day. Clearly, provenance here is all important. But how powerful are memories? We hold them dear and often pay accordingly. We also pay for our mistakes. But how costly could a misunderstanding be? And our next piece is taken from the internet. It's from news.artnet.com/market/auctions from the 19th of August. R.M. Sotheby's botched the $22 million sale of the first Porsche because bidders couldn't understand the auctioneer's accent. It was supposed to be a historic sale. Instead, it was the auction equivalent of a car crash. It was meant to be the star lot in a banner automobile sale for R.M. Sotheby's in Monterey Beach, California. Billed as the first Porsche, the 1939 Type 64 automobile was one of just three ever built and the only one to have survived. The car was estimated to sell for up to $22 million, but instead it failed to sell at all due to the embarrassing combination of technical difficulties and an apparently hard-to-parse Dutch accent. The auctioneer started the bidding at $13 million, or was that $30? From the start, the screen at the front of the room projected the higher number, which would be a pretty aggressive place to start, considering it was well above the high estimate. Viewers in the room started audibly gasping and clamouring to capture photos of the historic moment. The bids came in 500,000 increments, notching up to 40 million, then 50 million, then 60, and finally topping out at an astounding $70 million. That is, until auctioneer Martin Ten Holder caught on, quickly clarifying, "I'm saying 17, not 70," at which point the crowd immediately started booing and shouting in disbelief. According to collector David Lee, whose Instagram video of the event has been viewed by more than 250,000 times, it was difficult to understand Holder's accent, an opinion apparently shared by the technician manning the live bidding screen. Some people in the audience seemed to think it was a publicity stunt or an attempt to replicate the shredded Banksy incident at Sotheby's London sale in October. "They'd just lost so much credibility," Johnny Shaughnessy told Bloomberg's after witnessing the incident. Another apparently jaded viewer chimed in, "It worked for Banksy, it didn't work for RM." In a statement, RM Sotheby's said it was a totally inadvertent and unintentional mistake in which an unfortunate misunderstanding based on the incorrectly displayed bidding increments were compounded by excitement in the room. Later, the company said it had failed to meet the reserve price after topping out at $17 million, adding, "We will continue making every effort to sell the car." Moving now from motors to museums and to our identity crisis. And this comes from the Art newspaper. It was taken from the internet on the 19th of August 2019. What exactly is a museum? ICOM, that's the International Council of Museums, comes to blows over new definition. As 50-year-old statement is overhauled, feuds over new description could seriously weaken the International Council of Museums. And this was written by Vincent Noce. What exactly is a museum? If anyone knows, it should be the International Council of Museums, ICOM, with its 40,000 members representing more than 20,000 museums. But that very question is, in fact, fueling a bitter debate within the organisation and perhaps threatening its identity. On the 12th of August, 24 national branches, including those of France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Canada, and Russia, along with five museums' international committees, requested the postponement of a vote on a revised definition of museums in order to deliver a new proposal. The new definition was selected by ICOM's executive board in Paris on the 22nd of July, but major dissent has been predicted if the proposal, which constitutes a considerable shift, is adopted at its General Assembly on the 7th of September in Kyoto. For almost 50 years, ICOM has adhered to a statement defining the museum as a non-profit institution that acquires, conserves, researches, communicates, and exhibits the tangible and intangible heritage of humanity and its environment for the purposes of education, study, and enjoyment. But some people, including the Danish curator Jette Sandal, objected, saying it does not speak the language of the 21st century and that it does not reply to the current demands of cultural democracy. Sandal led the commission that put forward the new 100-word text defining the museum as democratising, inclusive and polyphonic spaces for critical dialogue about the past and the future. It adds, addressing the conflicts and challenges of the present, they hold artefacts and specimens in trust for society, safeguard diverse memories for future generations, and guarantee equal rights and equal access to heritage for all people. They are supposed to be participatory and transparent, work in active partnerships with and for diverse communities, and aiming to contribute to human dignity and social justice, global equality and planetary well-being. Juliette Raoul Duval, who chairs ICOM France, quickly denounced as ideological manifesto, published without consulting the national branches. At first I thought this was a joke, said Didier Rickner, the founder of Tribune de l'Art, attacking what he describes as an Orwellian newspeak that replaces artworks with artifacts and specimens. The definition should emphasise the importance of the museum's functions and its relationship to tangible and intangible heritage, which constitutes its distinguishing characteristics from other cultural institutions, claim the national committees which asked to delay the vote, deploring the political tone of Sandal's document. A former director of ICOM and one of the founders of the concept of new museology in the 1970s, Hugues de Varine, confesses that he was surprised by the overinflated verbiage of an ideological preamble, which does not distinguish a museum from a cultural centre, a library or a laboratory. The quarrel could be interpreted as a debate between the old guard and the younger generation, or between Latin tradition and the Anglo-Saxon move towards a more inclusive model. François Mares, a professor at the Université Sorbonne Nouvelle and chair of the International Committee of Museology, says the matter is more serious. He resigned in June from the commission headed by Sandal, claiming the proposal did not reflect the discussions held over 2 years. A definition is a simple and precise sentence characterising an object, and this is not a definition but a statement of fashionable values, much too complicated and partly aberrant, Mares says. It would be hard for most French museums, starting with the Louvre, to correspond to this definition, considering themselves as polyphonic spaces. The ramifications could be serious. ICOM's statement can be included in national or international legislation, and there is no way a jurist could reproduce this text. Mares adds that it does not take into account the extraordinary variety of museums. It would be disastrous to impose only one type of museum. If a vote breaks the consensus that has always governed ICOM, it will seriously weaken the organisation. So here's a question for you, or a good topic for a university debate. How applicable is terminology such as polyphonic spaces and aiming to contribute to human dignity and social justice, global equality and planetary well-being applicable to Sydney's Powerhouse Museum, Melbourne's National Gallery of Victoria, that's the NGV, or Beechworth's Burke Museum? And chuck in London's V&A, St. Petersburg's Hermitage, and New York's Met, and the list goes on. But the bottom line is, whatever you want to call them, they're all absolutely wonderful places to visit. So good luck, ICOM, in working out your definition. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.